Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com.
I say the hit, hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddies here. Welcome to Disco Daddies Wide World of Hip Hop. And today I'm sitting here with my producer, helping me on this show. And this is our debut show, our premiere actually. And I'm honored to have Robin Lynn Maven here assisting me with this and showing me all the fine points of internet radio broadcasting, which is a new field for me. And I am honored to have her brother, Anthony DJ Antron Maven, on the other end of this microphone. I am really honored, my brother. You're one of the few people who go way back to the early days of Rappers Rap Records who know anything about the history. And I'm going to sit back. We call him DJ Antron, y'all, okay? Because that's what he's affectionately known as. That's how he earned his professional name here on Wheels of Steel. And we're going to let you tell him about yourself, my brother. And then we're going to go into a little history of the West Coast scene that both you and I know back and forth and stuff. So, Anthony Antron Maven.
Yeah, that's right.
Welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. What's up, my brother?
History goes back. I was actually on the Greyhound bus on my way to Los Angeles for the first time when I heard Disco Daddy on the radio. I had my headphones on.
It had to be 1981, right?
Right, that. I said that.
Okay, okay.
I was in high school. So mm-hmm. I'm on my way, and Rapper's Rap was my life. So I moved to L.A., and I got into the hip-hop scene, and I met Duffy, and he became my first manager, and I became a recording engineer, and I met everybody.
Duffy Rhoades, who is the founder of Rappers Rap Records.
Oh, yeah, he was my manager.
Okay, let me ask you, though. What made you decide to come to L.A. in the first place? Why were you on that Greyhound bus? What was the first initial motivation to move from what, San Diego? Was it San Diego?
Yeah, my father snatched me.
Okay.
He took me out.
Meaning, he had something going on here? They brought you in on it?
I couldn't stay in San Diego anymore. I was too much. So my father said, I got to take him. So
starting in high school,
my father took me and moved me to L.A.
Gotcha.
And he was already a musician from Seattle and in lots of bands. And there's a lot of history there we don't have to talk about. But.
Right.
But he set me up with all the equipment I needed that I would play around with the music. So I'm not just a DJ. I'm a musicologist. It's about the music, the sound, the style. I would study the music. I would write the music. Plus, I'm a drummer. I'm a musician.
Right. Oh,
and
I didn't know that.
And my father was an audiophile. What that means is he had all the best equipment. So I would like really listen to the sound quality, the fidelity, and you know he had albums and record pulls. He's got everything. So I'm just playing around with his equipment when he's gone.
Right.
So in high school, I was the most qualified, the most advanced, so I just took over. And this is South Los Angeles.
Now, that's interesting. But I think when you get here, exactly what goes on, because you're also a part of a very special institution known as Radio, and then later Radio Tron. So tell us a little bit how you fell into that, how you got it, because you got to meet some very interesting people at the outset of the dawn of West Coast hip-hop.
Oh, yeah. Radiotron, I was looking for. I couldn't find it at first, back when the Glove was there. So I always give the Glove credit. I didn't find it when he was there, but then radio station K-Day had an ad. He said, DJ contest. So I just went to that. That's it. I went, K-Day said, DJ contest. And we caravan to the Radiotron. And I already made a record before that called Scratchmatic, Sound of the Street.
Scratchmatic on some record. Was out there. Okay.
Yeah. So I had a following. So when I came in there, I just swept it.
Wow.
And a DJ battle, and it was mostly about the crowd. It was judged by the crowd.
Okay.
And I'll tell you the secret, the girls.
Of course. The girls are secret to everything.
Yeah. No,
I used to go there. I know they had some fantastic females there.
They did for me. That's so funny. I saw it. Because my best friend, my number two, he said, you cheated. He said, oh, you just won because you had the crowd. And I said, isn't that how you win?
Exactly. You rub shoulders at the beginning of your career with other people at the beginning of their careers at the radio. Could you want to drop some names on us, my brother, so people see how deep you go in this West Coast hip-hop scene?
Of course. I was a battle DJ, which means I didn't make friends. I made enemies. Mm-hmm. I went straight through. All right. I'll drop the top one. Okay. Face-to-face fist fight with Ice-T.
Righteous.
Okay. I didn't fight Dr. Dre because I was tired. I just said, I don't need any more enemies. For some reason, I didn't fight with Dr. Dre because I was done. Kid Frost was my ally. But anybody else, it was no prisoners.
Okay. You knew Chris the Glove Taylor?
I did not.
You didn't meet Chris? Did Chris come in after you left?
No, he was before me.
Oh, he was before you. Oh, okay, I got you. All right, never
he
knew
was
that.
Before me.
Okay.
Now, Egypt, I would say he's my teacher, Egypt.
Both of them are on this show, too, with you.
He's my God. Mm-hmm. I could never diss Egypt. I could never diss the Glove. Okay. I was supposed to be in the group Two Live Crew, but I turned them down. They're from San Bernardino, by the way. Because remember, I'm with Duffy.
Right.
I'm working at a label. I got a club. I had my own shit going on. Oh,
right.
I cursed. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. But you would have had to go to Florida to work with them as well. Or were you?
That's
were,
right.
Two Live Crew was based out here for a minute, though.
He's from San Bernardino. He's from San Bernardino. He moved to Florida to live with his grandmother. I knew him before he moved to Florida.
Okay, I didn't know that either. Good enough. See, you're dropping bombs already, my brother. We only 15 minutes into this show. DJ Antron and Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Continue, my brother. I'm sorry.
Let's see,
early days. Rap label. Great. How did you meet Duffy?
Okay, the same day. Well, Arabian Prince used to come to my high school, and Arabian taught me a lot in the early days. He used to come, and I met Duffy, like you said, at a K-Day street scene. I was trying to think of a name. DJ Anonymous.
It might have been an L.A. street scene. Was it downtown L.A., around the City Hall?
Yeah, and Techno Hop was there, DJ Anonymous.
Okay. Okay, that was the L.A. street scene given by Tom Bradley. K-Day did have a stage there. I handled the hip-hop stage for the street scene. I remember that very well.
You are the godfather of Los Angeles.
Well, that's all right. That's all right, my brother. But you started working with Duffy, and I appreciate you. But you started working with Duffy and his father, and you took part in production of, or the mixing or engineering of some of Duffy's records. You want to name some of those because they're classic joints.
Well, I was recording engineer, and there were so many songs, some released, some not. I don't know.
Right.
At the time, we were at Leon Haywood Studio.
Okay.
And they were finishing Battle Ram.
Leon Haywood, you guys out there may not know this. He produced She's a Bad Mamma Jamma for Carl Carlton. So that's
who. And I was at his studio too.
Working with. Okay, there you go. DJ Antron was in the mix with all of this stuff that's going down. Very lively LA scene, very fertile period in hip hop in Los Angeles. And you, all of a sudden, you're right smack dab in the middle of it. Did you have any sense at that time that you were right smack dab in the middle of a lot of history, or were you just out there on the ground?
I was a puppy.
Looking back.
Nope. I was a baby. I was a puppy. I was just coming into the game and growing and learning. I mean, I wasn't ready to fight Ice-T. Face to face, he's 8 years older than me, and he wanted to fist fight me, and I was like, What was that?
I'm going to take you off subject. Do you want to talk about that? Because it's old, but it's interesting. You know, it illuminates a part of the history, like I said, people don't know about. That's why we have this show. What was that about? You may have to go in deep into it, but what happened exactly?
That's because we're from different crews and different cliques, and when you're a battle, you just get into battles and some shit. And I'm not going to say exactly why, because...
Right. You don't have to go into it, but
because you know, but
I just want to know, was it resolved? And years later, have you had a chance to see the brother again? And did it actually get into a fist fight? And who won?
African Islam broke up our fight. And
African Islam broke it up. Okay.
Okay. There was nobody hit. Nobody was hit. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay. Okay.
It was word. Started, and they broke us up.
Okay.
QD3, Quincy Jones III, he settled all beefs. There's no beefs anymore in L.A., not through us.
Okay. Beautiful.
So
beautiful.
So me and I,
and QD3,
we don't
Quincy
have...
Quincy Jones, Quincy Delight Jones III, that's who he's talking about. When it
right.
Okay. I know him.
Because I worked on 2D3 had a film called Beef, and I helped him on that series. So he settled it, and I said, good. There's no beef.
Wow.
And the reason we had a beef is gone anyway.
Cool. Okay.
Damn, that's
a lot of part of LA history, y'all. You're only going to read about when DJ Antron writes
it. I can't say it. I cannot say her name.
Okay. Cherchez la femme, they say in France. You know what I'm saying? Whenever something intrigues, they say, look for the woman. There must be a woman involved. Cherchez la femme.
How do you know?
You are young.
All females that came through the Radiotron came through me. Enough said.
That would piss off some people, probably. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
But
I don't care. I started as a battle DJ. I like the battle.
Right.
That's what I do.
Okay. That's what you do. I hear you.
But
you moved on. Go ahead, my brother. You want to finish that point.
Let's see. Coolio used to come through. Dr. Dre and Ed Lover used to come through to the club. I already said Two Live Crew. But
right.
Coolio, because Coolio looked crazy. We didn't know he was going to be a star.
He didn't change much either once he did.
I used to say, that nigga looked crazy.
Crazy.
So Radiotron was kind of like the crossroads of Los Angeles. Not gangster, but hip-hop.
Right. Hip-hop. Right.
There were
before,
two
this is before gangster rap anyway. This is before gangster rap anyway, the period we're talking
That's right.
about. For those
gangster
of you listening who don't. Right.
Right.
So there was no imagery about that yet. Okay.
So I saw it change. I saw how it the culture changed. And, I've seen a lot of our people get into that life, and it didn't go good.
Okay. Well, you moved on from that. You moved on,
yep.
And you went into films. I'd like to know now, Mr. Anthony, DJ Antron Maven, exactly about your how you transitioned from being a DJ and got into film production and some of the high-grossing-ass films you've worked on. People need to hear that. You had a very interesting life, my brother.
Okay. Well, my car got shot up at Ultrawave over some beef, so I decided I'm out. I left the street. I said, I'm out.
Okay. That would do it for me, too, I think.
And again, over a girl, a different one. And then, I was a recording engineer for Rapper's Rap, so I really learned computers. I mean, really learned them on my own time.
Right.
So somehow I got a job working on NASA contracts. So I did that for a few years. Right when the LA riots dropped. That's
1993. Yeah. 92, actually, but same period.
Oh, 92, 93.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So then I'm working for NASA. And I'm thinking, all this technology, wouldn't it be cool to use this for films? So that's how I made the switch. So it took me 4 years. And then the first film, I wanted to work with Arnold Schwarzenegger, so I did. And then Michael Jackson.
Wow. Which one?
Well, we did Thriller, too.
Wow, man. That's about as deep as you can get. That was for Sony, right? Did Michael produce it himself? Well, no. I'm just saying, as far as the entertainment, for to work with the top people in the business, Michael Jackson.
Dan Winston produced it. He's the creature maker for Jurassic Park, and he has a studio. Mm. It was Stan Winston put it together. The budget was about $1 million, $2 million.
Right.
I mean, this is big shit, and we're inventing the technology because I took my computer science. You know, I have an honorary PhD in computer science that I taught myself, and I'm a high school dropout at the same time.
And you were learning a computer, teaching yourself at a time when they were just coming into public.
Get that. Okay. I taught myself.
Gotcha, brother. That's heavy.
So then we did Thriller 2. I mean, it's out. I posted it lots of times. The official title is Ghost, but we call it Thriller 2. That's with Michael Jackson. And then, I work with Rolling Stones, Macy Gray, N.W.A., Bone Thugs and Harmony, Corrupt, and then so many people I forgot.
I think we can see a lot of influence in the work that you've done, the hip-hop influence you've injected into the projects you've worked on for people. You know, you put a sensibility, a hip-hop sensibility, which is like a stamp of your creativity in just about everything you've done. You've never lost your hip-hop sensibility. And this past summer, it was a great honor for me to work with you for the Radiotron thing last summer and bring you on board there, bring you back home to the Radiotron where you began. And I'd like to know what you got planned for the future, man. I know you got something cooking over there, man. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah? Okay. I have a new team I'm building, and the captain, front and center in my team, because I'm the coach, but on the field.
Okay.
It's Darcy. Darcy Carpenter, you've heard of her.
Okay, right. She's a friend on Facebook. I remember she got at me and y'all been talking. Okay, and she's truly talented, huh?
Right. So she's a model. She's mm-hmm. first of all, she's a 10. So let's start with that.
Okay.
10. Okay. And she's a recording artist. And we're recruiting lots of artists. And we got some artists, we don't want to say their name, but they're big. They're already international stars. They've made movies. We have access to everybody. And she's kind of helping coordinate all this access. So we have a new team of artists and super producers, and I'm the coach because I don't want to be on the field. I'm shy. Mm-hmm. I'm behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. I can't believe I'm doing this interview.
Well, your experience level actually puts you in the right position to be able to have the that position to be able to sit back and coach because people will listen to you. They have respect for what you've done, just like I do, and anybody else who reads your resume. So basically, and it's beautiful that we've lived long enough to still be healthy enough to enjoy this level of the entertainment business. You and I.
Like I told you last night, Cheryl the Pearl called me, and I had a crush on her when I was 15 years old. So today I'm like, wow. So I'm pushing people along. I'm like, play her new song. It sounds great. It's good. So
I'm gonna tell you something, OG. I'm gonna tell you something. The show that you're gonna be on, she just agreed to be interviewed. So her interview is gonna air on the same show as yours. She's gonna hit it.
Oh, thank you so much. Hey,
she agreed this afternoon to do the interview. So I said we'll make the show with her. Yeah, you her. Antron, we have two other guests we may add on, but other than that, right now you and her are confirmed. I think that's going to be July 15th. It's July 15th.
That is so great.
Yeah, it is beautiful. See, this is what I'm saying, man. We're still around years later and still be blessed to be doing something that we both love to do. You know what I'm saying? I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think of the current state of hip-hop now? I mean, everybody has their opinion on not just rappers, but the way awards are given out, different aspects of the business now. What is your take on the whole hip-hop? We know it's a worldwide culture now, but as far as
what I really notice right now is I wonder who is putting money behind promoting this, whatever, because I turn on my radio and in my car, and the beats bump. They turn my car out. It's like, oh, these beats are bumped. but the rap, whatever, come on, it's so bad. Yeah. But the beats are good.
Luckily.
I just wonder who is putting in money, dumping in money to promote this.
Exactly.
Because it's terrible.
Do you feel that there's a conspiracy, like some people feel?
I do. That's why I said, who is this?
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, I hear you.
Straight up.
I hear you.
Just like they're saying. Because, come on, man, it's bad.
Yeah, it is.
It's really bad.
It is.
What happened to real music? What happened to artistry? This stuff, they're promoting it over and over. I hear the same songs over and over. Like, it's embarrassing to me.
They're going to make you like this song, in other words. They're going to hammer it into your head.
Right, that's
and
the airway.
And make you like it. But, that's a very interesting look. A lot of people feel that way also, even down to the way the awards are handed out to skipping over established black artists, not just in hip-hop, but in other musical genres also, to hand out awards to some of the newly created stars, let's say. You know what I'm saying? Like someone is controlling who the next generation of this or that is going to be. You understand what I'm saying? Whereas before, when they were record stores, you made a record, you put it out there, and people came to buy it if they liked it. You know what I'm saying?
I've only heard one song this year I like, and that's Redbone.
Okay, I'm not
everything
into it.
Else.
I know Redbone, but I haven't. Okay, let's check that.
Redbone, that's number one on Billboard's R&B.
Got you. Wow.
Childish Bambino, you heard of it. You know. Number one. It's right. Number one.
Okay.
But well, the Migos barely pass a little bit, but even Drake sounds like shit now.
I guess once they get up there, they don't feel they have to work as hard. They can release something with their name on it. It's going to sell a million units. You know what I'm saying? Until the word gets around that it's bunk or whatever. You see what I'm saying? A lot of artists get to that level where they can sell a certain amount of units just on their name. You know?
You know, I talked to the president of Motown, Al Bell. Whoever's pushing this stuff can make anything a hit. Because they put it in the lane. So I'm like, who is pushing this? Who is pushing it? Not right. You know, you put a third in the fast lane, and that's a number one. I mean, when they blocked Prince, Prince had 30 number one songs on Emancipation when they blocked him. See, now that was pure quality. But today, I don't know.
DJ Antron, if your children, any one of your children was telling you they wanted to get into the music business right now, what would be the advice you would give them?
My 17-year-old daughter, she's creating new music. She's gifted and talented. So she's going to make new creations, and I give her the tools. I bought her all the equipment she needed. So she's being creative, you know what I'm saying? She's still in high school, but she's making new stuff.
Right.
And she's doing spoken word, which is it's not rap, but you know what I'm saying. She's being creative.
Okay.
So she might create something. Who knows? I need to hear something new.
I got you. But you have no reservations. You wouldn't tell her, well, I don't think show business is a good thing to get into or anything like that. You have basically a balanced view of the whole thing.
No, all my kids are in college. For you know, my oldest, she's 23. She's going for her PhD in psychology. To answer your question, that's going to be a side thing. The first thing, get your education, get your career, and be solid. Because you cannot wish on a hope. Because it's not guaranteed.
Yes, sir. And you've heard years of wisdom talking to my audience out there from Mr. Anthony, DJ Antron Maven. What he just said is the result and accumulation of years of experience in this business. My brother, we want to thank you for everything you've done in hip-hop. You're one of the most unheralded, unsung forces behind a lot of the popular music that emerged from old school L.A. And I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for doing my program, being gracious enough to introduce me to your sister, who is the producer of the program and who is a
one-of-a-kind
in herself. She is a world unto herself. Yes, a genius in what she does. So I feel like I'm with family right now. She's sitting here and I'm on the phone with her brother. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's been a beautiful interview. And my brother, I want to wish you a blessed day. I wish I had another half an hour to spend with you, but you know how radio is. Okay? But I love you, DJ Antron.
Thank you so much.
And I want to wish you the best. And anything that you do, you got Disco Daddy support.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, my brother. Peace and blessings. We out, y'all. Disco Daddy's wide world of hip-hop.
Vibes Lives has something very special for you right after church. Gospel brunch and sunshine. I am Robin Lynn, and join me for Jazz with Jay every Sunday and a glass of wine on VibesLive.com. 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to Disco Daddy's wide world of hip-hop. And today, we've really all been blessed. We've been blessed with the presence of a man who goes way back to the beginning on the west coast of the beginning of hip-hop recording, and he's known as Mellow Man Ace. How you doing today, my brother?
Yo, that's a great intro. I appreciate it. I'm doing well. But, I won't say I was here in the beginning. I'll say maybe not day one, but day two for sure.
Okay.
You was day one. I'm a day two. But, yes, thank you.
Okay, we're going to let you break it down because this is what we're going to do. We're going to let you talk about your early days, where you were born and grew up, and what influenced you to go into music and basically what Mellow Man Ace is all about. So start with your earliest recollections, where you were born and grew up.
Yeah.
Mellow Man Ace on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop.
No doubt. I was born in Pinar del Río, Cuba, in Cuba, of course, 1967. My family migrated after I won the Cuban lottery to leave the island in 1971.
Wow.
Spent small time on the East Coast. Of course, we were claimed in Miami by a family member that was already here. He took us into Jersey. And then my parents chose the relocation of Los Angeles based off the weather and that the ground only shook once every 20 years. So we've been in L.A. ever since. My earliest recollection to music has to be my grandfather, who I'm named after, Ulpiano Reyes. He was a great composer in Cuba. He composed the Cuban national anthem and about 16 danzón rhythms on the island that were famously re-recorded by other artists as the years went on. And that's my earliest recollection of music because my father used to write his notes for him, as my grandfather didn't know how to write music, but he could play it. So my father would translate his lyrics onto the sheets. I'm sorry, not the lyrics, the notes. And,
the music,
The music. So that was my earliest recollection, seeing my father writing on this line paper these funny little notes and whatnot. But, and then when we got to the States, I we were heavily influenced, as I started to realize and come of age around 7 or 8 years old, we would hear, the Isley Brothers and Steely Dan on the radio and the Jackson 5 and, of course, LTD and all those groups, and later on really starting to understand what it all meant, Of course, even Elvis Presley, we would hear those records. There were so many influences. You're talking about, one of the most important eras of music was in the 70s, and you had so many things going on. You had everything from the Led Zeppelins to Ohio Players and, of course,
Motown.
Parliament and Cameo as they came in, and you would start to really hear these records. But that's my earliest recollections of music, and I think in sixth grade, the tallest girl in the class, her name was Madre Cross, she invited
There's
me.
There's always a family. Girl in the story.
Well, Madre Cross invited me to dance at a school dance, and I was able to finally, show her what my older sister Myra had taught me on the dance floor. And I believe, if I'm correct, it had to be one of those Isley Brothers songs. I forget if it was Who's That Lady I'm drawing a blank here. It had to be
Fight the Power, was the one of the up-tempo.
Yeah, it was.
I got work to do. I got work to do.
Mm-mm.
Okay, but it was up-tempo rock and Isley.
To make a long story short, but yeah, no doubt. That's pretty much it. That's the beginning, It's where I started to understand
music. But what happened?
Well, we were innocent kids at that time in the 70s. It was sixth grade, so nothing happened after that.
You were just mentioning that was the musical influences that were around you at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, you started to discover everything else after that.
What happened to make you decide, at what point were you drawn into this new developing music, which later became known as hip-hop? In the beginning, there was no name on it, but guys and girls were rapping. There were a few groups. What groups were around at the time you entered into the culture?
Well, the beautiful thing for me, growing up 1,500 miles or however far it is in the Bronx, New York, I remember there was a kid who moved, 3,000 miles from here to the East Coast, right? There was a kid who came to school who had just moved from New York, Italian kid by the name of Carmine Shalace. He was the first kid I saw with a boombox, even though, you know, everybody was doing it. I'm sure
right.
It was a boombox in South Central. I didn't grow up in South Central. I grew up in a city called Southgate. And in Southgate, this kid, Carm, came to school with a boombox one day, and he was playing two records that I'll never forget. One was Rapper's Delight, and the other one was something by Curtis Blow. Could have been The Breaks. The year was like 1979.
Right.
In 79, he did this in junior high school, and I was like, wow, what is that? And then he was eight. He was really dope at Electric Boogaloo, and I've never seen it. So that's like the first virus that I caught for hip-hop.
Right.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't start doing it later until I started writing lyrics in English class in high school, which the fascination of putting words together and the way definitions of words really intrigued me in high school. I used to love to be the first one to finish my definitions and beat everybody else in the class, and I think that started the fascination for writing, and it had to be like 1982-ish, 83-ish in there. But by that time, we were listening to records like Sucker MCs and, you know, stuff like that, early UTFO stuff, and records like that. Of course, you know, we had, I believe, Toddy T and the Bataram, and them were coming in.
Bataram. Yeah,
and we were, you know, of course, World Class Wrecking Crew. And those are the records that, you know, now in the 80s I started to listen to, with Egyptian Lover and all those guys.
Okay.
And for me, it was because I was kind of slow coming from another country to learn the language. I couldn't make the grade to play sports, and I was a really good pitcher. So luckily for me, hip-hop came along, which then my father connected by telling me, of course, again, my grandfather's connection to music. My uncle, who I'm also named after, he's also a musician. His kids are all musicians. And so it all made perfect sense when I stopped playing baseball to just go into breakdancing and b-boying as my entry-level position in hip-hop.
Okay, so you were B-boy first before you started rapping.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We used to go to Venice Beach, 83, 84. My older homeboy, Cuban Cat, that had also moved from New York to here, to L.A., Robert Rodriguez, would put us, you know, in his little car and take the conga drums down up to Venice Beach for a walk. I'd lay out the cardboard, and he would play the congas with his boys, Skilo and them. And and I would be the B-boy. And then we'd generate, you know, money on the boardwalk and stuff like that, and have a good old time. So that's how we – that was my entry, really, you know, like catching the virus full-fledged.
Okay, at some point, Mellow Man Ace picks up a microphone.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. How did that happen?
I was writing rhymes in high school, like I said, and in my neighborhood, there was two Cuban clubs, right? Usually where the elders would get together on the weekends, and they would dance salsa and stuff like that. Well, one year, they decided to let the kids have a little something, and one of the other kids brought some turntables. And it was the club called the Oginetto down on California Street in Southgate, where I really picked up the first mic.
What year?
There.
What year
this
is it?
This was 1985 now, 85, 84.
Okay.
I would say 85.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I started by rapping in Spanish. I had this real dirty Spanish rap that I had wrote. It had
right.
no bar structure. It didn't have no hook or nothing. It was just
right.
at that time, we was just battling. So the rhyme was really more of a battle style rhyme in all Spanish.
Okay.
But by that time, I had heard records like the Mean Machine Disco Dream, which is where a classic hip hop record on Sugar Hill Records, which one of the MCs by the name of Mr. Schick broke off into a like a 8-bar Spanish rap. And I remember thinking to myself, one day I'm going to be like that guy. Except,
okay.
so back then, remember, you couldn't just bite, right? So
right.
I said, I'm going to take that little piece and add on to it and make my own originality. So I wrote a whole song. And then later on, I would create the bilingual rhyme style that became notorious.
Wow. Okay. So you pick up a microphone, you start rapping. Eventually, you either get discovered. How did you start to first record your first record?
Well, I'm moving a little ahead. So the first time I would say
okay.
I picked up a microphone in a professional setting was
uh-huh.
at the original Radiotron with the legend and the great master teacher for me, Tony G, was on the turntable. After
wow.
I had honed my skills battling in Southgate and Linwood, Huntington Park, and Bell, somebody had invited us to go up the Radiotron. It was
this,
myself.
This had to be, what, 83, 84, or 85,
right.
just
yeah,
before
right.
they closed?
Right before they closed. And it was myself, a rapper by the name of Chilly Chill, who later would
mm-hmm.
become and change his name to Be Real of Cypress Hill. And I remember
cool.
it was myself and at that time Chilly Chill. We went there and Tony G was on the decks and we began to write, you know, to bust on the mic. And I remember we were so rookie, the way I like to tell it is Chilly Chill missed his cue on the beginning of the rap like two times.
Uh-huh.
And we had to start the whole thing over, you know what I mean?
Oh.
It was a good old day. It was a good old day, man, before, you
right,
know.
Right, yeah, still having fun, yeah.
And so, you know, Tony G was great. He never said, hey, man, get the hell off the stage. Y'all not ready. He never said that. And I think... that would come back into play later on, 5 years later or so. I'm sorry, like 3 years later or so. And I thought nothing of it. We went there. We felt Chilly Chill, Be Real, whatever you want to call him at that time, right?
Right,
We felt, you know, we went home disappointed because, you know, we had to start the song three times. You know what I mean? So
right,
anyway,
yeah,
I continued on my quest. My man... Be Real, at that time, he kind of gave up on it. And he went and started hanging out in South Central. But I continued and believed in myself that I would make it somehow, some way, someday, you know?
Right on. Right on.
And so the great master Tony G, years later, I met a guy by the name of Kid Frost, who had been rapping in all English. He was a Latino kid. Mexican,
mm-hmm.
Chicano, but he hadn't
mm-hmm.
written in Spanish yet at that time. He had a record
wow.
called The Terminator out at that time. He was,
mm-hmm.
He had a good reputation out on the street, you know, and
right.
he would
right.
rock with Handyman and those guys and Ice-T and them dudes, you know, at that time. So,
right.
I forget, I believe it was Julio G, DJ Julio G, the Mixmaster, who also went to my high school, who introduced me then to later on to Tony G in a formal way.
Oh, and
I was like,
okay.
yo, that's crazy because I told Tony that day when I met him for real with Julio, I said, you were the DJ that was spending the day that me and Be Real was at Radio John.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's when it all started to make sense, because as I then got my first record deal on Delicious Vinyl in 87, 88, Tony G, I went to be the producer of the track.
Wow.
Of the tracks, you see.
Okay.
So that's how it all came together. And it was Tony G, the great, I call him the great master teacher. He's the one that really showed me how to write in bar structure, what's a hook, what's, you know, what is 2 bars, what is 8 bars, what is 16 bars.
Wow.
All these things,
wow.
I had no idea what I was doing.
Right.
All I knew is that I had a record to make, and, you know, I was lucky at that time to be in the right place at the right time.
At the right time. Is Tony T still around?
Tony G is still around. He's still around. Okay. He has a studio in El Monte, and he's doing his thing, and he puts on some type of scratch academy school and things of that nature. So, yeah.
Okay. So now, at what point in your career did you adopt the name Mellow Man Ace, and where did that come from?
No doubt. Mellow Man Ace came from a cypher we had on Cypress Hill Avenue in Southgate at the time. And I remember we used to walk around with a little tape recorder with the mini cassettes in them, right?
So one night
we getting blizzied out, you know, 40s and whatever, and somebody started banging a beat on a car hood. And it was myself, my brother, who at that time his name was Haji Chief. Y'all might know him as Sendog of Cypress Hill. He was a really big Egyptian Lover fan at that time, so he called himself Haji Sheik, right? So it was myself.
Right.
At that time, I went by the rapper Ace Cool, because I was starting to be a big LL Cool J fan, and anything cool,
okay.
DJ Cool, Red Alert, all that stuff.
Right.
So
now, what year is this happening?
Now we're talking about 86, beginning of 87,
gotcha.
In there.
Okay.
Right,
okay.
So one night we just getting blizzied out in the hood. Somebody start banging a car, but my boy, his name is Tomahawk Funk, a Funk Dubious. Tyrone also grew up with us, right?
Wow.
So he starts busting the rap, and he says, "I'm chilling with." Oh, you know what? Sendog's name had already evolved from Haji Sheik to Down Rock. Okay, so
now he says,
Tyrone says, "I'm chilling on the street with Down Rock and my Mellow Man Ace." Okay, I thought nothing of it. I thought nothing
right.
of it. Because if you remember at that time, if you had a homeboy, that was your mellow.
Okay.
Right? Now, we're talking about East Coast principle, you know, hip-hop
right.
type of thing, right? So if somebody
right.
was your homeboy, oh, yo, that's my Mellow Larry, or that's my Mellow
T-Boy. Yo, my Mellow.
Whatever it was.
Yeah, yeah. I
remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah.
I thought nothing of it. But the next morning, I woke up and I said, "Man, well, let me play and see what we did, you know, off the cassette."
Mm-hmm.
So then I'm listening to the whole cypher, and we're all gathered around listening to what we had did while we was faded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my man says, "My Mellow Man Ace." And I'm like, "Mellow Man Ace, that sounds cool." You know, remember, because a lot of MCs had the three names at that time. You had Cool Mo Dick, Big Daddy.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So it made a lot of sense. LL Cool J, you know.
What were you calling yourself up to that point?
I was calling myself Ace Cool.
Ace Cool, okay.
Ace Cool. But then I heard that just roll off the tongue on the cassette, and I'm like, "Mellow Man Ace, that sounds kind of hard. They got a rhythm to it." And I just went ahead and rolled with it.
Okay. Now, me and you had a conversation about the Latino music culture as far as hip-hop. You used the term a subculture within a subculture. Let's talk about that for a minute, on your take on the development, first of all. You can't tell, I don't know too much about the East Coast. Well, I do now because of my interviews. But I know the development of West Coast hip-hop, you cannot leave out Latino influence and Latino pioneers when you mention Kid Frost and yourself. But you use the term of a subculture within a subculture when we were referring to Latinos in hip hop. Did you mean that with just a West Coast anomaly, or did you mean that in music in general, as far as hip hop is concerned, that you view it as a subculture within a subculture? Why don't I'm gonna let you explain what you were
like? Like I say, it's a culture within a subculture. It's a subculture within a culture. Right, and so when you think about hip hop in its early stages of the early 80s, late 70s to early 80s, you had the Puerto Rican element, and there was some Cuban kids in there as well. You have DJs like Charlie Chase, my fellow brother, fellow Cuban DJ Disco Wiz. You had Prince Whipple Whip. You had Ruby Dee, and of the Romantic Fantastic Five. And you had several others like Mr. Schick of the Mean Machine. So I grew up off these records. However, none of them really, other than Mr. Schick, rapped in Spanish. So those were my early influences, right? So I said, I'm at the turn of the time when you started to hear Fight the Power and Public Enemy being proud to be black, I said, well, I'm proud to be Latino. I'm Afro and Latino. So I was like, okay, when I get my shot, I'm going to put it out there. Just be proud of you, too. You could do this, too. And then as I did the knowledge on hip-hop, I discovered all these other Latino elements and beat boys who were there at the inception of the creation of the culture. And so I said, this makes perfect sense. However, it wasn't until a press day at Capitol Records after I had left Delicious Vinyl and went to Capitol Records, a brother by the name, a journalist, I should say, by the name of Soren Baker, who at the time wrote for The Source, did an interview with me on press day. And he says this, and I quote, he starts his interview by saying, so how does it feel to be the godfather of Latino hip hop? Boom. My electricity light, my Einstein moment happens once there.
Wait, what year were we talking now that happened?
I was already successful, so we're talking 91 during that press day. Okay, this was after I had already created the bilingual rhyme style known as Spanglish. And we'll take it back. We'll take it back a little bit in a minute, but I think it's worth saying here that it was Soren Baker who coined it, not myself. And, you know, as in this hip-hop thing, it's vital that sometimes you find a niche. Yes? Can we agree?
Yes, I do.
You have to find your niche, as they say. And so I found my niche there and decided to run with it, even though creating the style, the bilingual rhyme style, was really the niche first. And we'll get into that and how that style came about, I'm sure.
Okay. Now, does that limit you as far as you commercially with the record companies? Did they, you have any problems with them wanting you to be more commercial and just not just have a niche style? Was there pressure on you to, in other words, open up and go with the flow where hip-hop seemed to be going at that time? Because what you did, when we look back on it, is revolutionary, actually. Okay.
I appreciate that. That's heavy.
Yes, it was, because at that time, I remember, and only the OGs do remember, that hip-hop was popping everywhere by that time. And there was really no looking at color, per se, or race. But it was there in the sense that, you know, when somebody got up on the stage, they say, oh, he's Latino. But nobody ever judged you by that. They judged by what you spit.
Yes.
You see what I'm saying? So by you taking it to another level and rapping in two languages, what kind of reception, first of all, did you get from audiences? Well, obviously, that you had a niche audience. But basically, when people saw you for the first time, had never seen you, what was it like for seeing Mellow Man Ace from your perspective?
Yeah, most definitely.
You know what I'm getting at that time? How was your style accepted?
No doubt, no doubt. And I think here it's worth saying that I can't skip over the importance of those struggle years there between 85 to 87, 88, where we would be, I would be playing, I'll speak for myself in this sense here, I would be playing the ASCAP showcase with you know, showcases with Greg Mack hosting, Lisa Canning, and of course, Curtis Harmon and those guys. You know, those years were vital because it was there that I started to hone my presentation skill. You see, now I'm playing these tough crowds in South Central LA and all Crip neighborhoods or all blood neighborhood, and you had to show and prove, right?
Right,
so as a black Latino, at first, black folk was like, oh, hell no, we don't understand that. However, the Latinos in the crowd were wilding out.
Right.
You see, so it was a 50-50 mixed response. Black folks, of course. The other 50% of me was like, we don't really get it. I guess it's cool, but whatever. Who's next?
Right.
Was wilding out. So then the judges and Rory Kaufman and all these people, Greg Mack, were wowed by the Spanish delivery, right? So I would win a lot of those contests because I was different.
Different. Okay.
It was my own difference that made me acceptable, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think what happened was Delicious Vinyl caught wind of it, and one day I found myself in a studio with DJ Muggs of Cypress Hill, who was recording a track for the movie Colors called Why with the group 783, and I happened to go to the studio that day. And so Delicious Vinyl says to me, hey, we just signed a guy by the name of Tone Loke and another guy named Young MC. We're looking for rappers to sign. I'm like, I rap in Spanish too. And they were like, Spanish? Let us hear something. And so I start busting that same dirty little rap I told you a while back.
Right.
And they was like, stop. You sound like the Latino LL Cool J out there smug. You know what I mean? So they said, why don't you come back tomorrow? We'll put you on some tracks and see what you sound like. Man, I came back the next day. I one take Jake did. It was that long 87 bar rap with no hook stuff in it. They just loved it, so they broke the thing up.
Man.
They brought in Tony G to break down the verses. And then we put it out. Now that's when Latinos all over, because you know, we ended up taking it to the Compton Swap Meet, the Slauson Swap Meet, you know, all these other things, the Rhodium with Mr. Steve Yano down there, rest in peace. And then that's when the Latino culture just woke the hell up, like, oh, shit.
What year was that released?
Now we're talking about 1987,
88
in there.
Gotcha. Now, give us a little history on Delicious Vinyl.
Yeah, Delicious Vinyl was started by Matt Dykes, Michael Ross, who at that time were calling themselves the Dust Brothers on the production tip. It was just two white boys who later I found out were Jewish, actually, right? And they were just starting this thing out of this little, on top of an appliance store down on Melrose Ave, I believe it was, or Santa Monica Boulevard. Right? One of those. I forget what street it was on. And I ended up there that day, but Delicious Vinyl was key in believing in Spanish rap as the first label that really stepped to the forefront and said, we want to put this out.
Wow.
And of course, you know, everybody knows the Dust Brothers, who then produced for the Beastie Boys and, you know, and then would do stuff with Rick Rubin and all those guys.
Right. And you went from there to Capitol. What was the reason that the relationship dissolved with Delicious?
Yes. No, it did. It never did, actually. And to this day, we're very good friends, and I was just with them down on the weekend. Here's how that happened.
Wow.
Delicious Vinyl sets up a concert at San Diego State University for myself, Tone Loc, I believe Young MC was there, and a legend from New York by the name of T. La Rock. And at that time, T. La Rock had two dancers with him by
it's
the name
yours.
Of Nice and Smooth. Yes.
Right. Okay.
The
right.
big record was It's Yours, of course.
It's Yours. Uh-huh.
Paragraph expert, da 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 da. Yeah, it's yours.
Yours,
so we go down
yeah.
there. Yeah, so we go down there, San Diego State. We swear we're going to rock it. We're going to kill it. And, you know, and it's going to be crazy. It's going to be, man, we made it. You know, we our first big mm-hmm. concert, you know. Man, we mm-hmm. get there that night, man. San Diego State University was 10 people in the whole concert hall. 10 people. But like my mom's always said, at that time, you know, I had Cypress Hill was my dancers. And and the legend T. La Rock had Nice and Smooth as his dancers.
Uh-huh.
DJ Muggs was my DJ at that time. So we go in there, and I remember hearing my mother's voice, who always used to tell me and my brother, you give 100%, whether it's one person or 1,000. She always
or 1,000.
That.
That's right. Yes, the show must go on. Okay.
Yeah, the show must go on. So I go on stage, and I give it 110. My whole crew does, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we kill it. After that set, I'm standing at the back of the hall watching Tone Loc perform. And that's when a man came up to me by the name of Kenny Ortiz. He had a business card in his hand, and he said, hey, look, I'm Kenny Ortiz, Capitol Records representative. Capitol Records had me come down here to San Diego, check out your show, and let you know we want to give you a record deal.
Wow.
Like, whoa, wait a minute.
Wow.
Wait a minute. There's only 10 people here, and the ninth person is a representative for Capitol Records. Well, I'm tripping.
Yeah.
I'm tripping because I had already signed with Delicious Vinyl. So I tell this man, I said, well, I'm already signed to Delicious Vinyl. He goes, don't worry about that. We're going to buy out the contract.
Wow. Wow.
Then,
they wanted
back to L.A.
They wanted Mellow Man Ace. They wanted Mellow Man.
Man is shit, yes. Pardon my friend. Right? So as we get back to L.A. the following week, I call the man. He sets everything up. And I come to find out that he, too, was Afro-Cuban.
How great
Ortiz,
is that?
Last name Ortiz.
How
that's a Latino
that?
Name. But he was just like a Stone Cold brother, you see? So he was just like me, Afro-Latino. He was already within the gates of the infrastructure at Capitol and understood the vision.
Gotcha.
So then the talks began with Delicious Vinyl and Capitol. Capitol, I believe, offered them somewhere around $45,000 to buy out my contract. And because Delicious Vinyl needed the money to make more records on Tone Loc and Young MC, it made perfect sense, right?
Okay.
Because they couldn't keep up with their demand at that time.
Right.
So now they got a fresh $45,000 to press up more Tone Loc and Young MC. I then venture off to Capitol, and that's when I created the bilingual rhyme style known as the bilingual, you know, the Spanglish stuff when I started doing the first album, which, of course, I went right to Tony G, the master teacher, to produce it.
Uh-huh. Now, how were the sales on that worldwide? I don't want to just know the United States sales, because what you're doing, obviously, there are millions of people. Did they do a worldwide distribution? You were Capitol. I assume that they did. What kind of, how was the Spanglish accepted?
Yes, indeed. If you remember correctly, Capitol had a Latino division by the name of EMI.
Mm-hmm.
EMI was brought in to service it in Latin America. And they sure did.
Right.
And we ended up doing over $2 million in sales worldwide.
Man.
I have the
that
black
is a record. That had, you had to establish a record for a Latino artist in hip-hop at that time, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, it wasn't the norm, being that these records of mine, the first one, the Dirty Spanish Rap, and then when you're talking about Mentirosa, that really set the standard and opened the door for Latinos on a bigger level, because I never closed that door behind me, you see. And so then, by then, you know, we got to see Kid Frost started to rap and got with Tony G and started to rap in bilingual format as well with me in okay. our camp, right?
Yeah.
So then,
right.
of course, that opens the door for Cypress Hill. Then later, a year or two after, and then they dropped, you know, How I Could Just Kill a Man, and the rest was history on that. But then Lighter Shade of Brown was able to get in. You see what I'm saying? Little by little, then we started to hear Fat Joe and Big Pun and all these other guys come through.
So you were the pioneer, the foundation of all of that, although not many people will point at it and say that, but I'm going to say it because obviously what you did reverberated throughout the Latino community, which had embraced hip-hop from the beginning, as we all know. But your
I'm not a prideful dude like that. I'm gonna always give props to the one and only Mr. Schick of the Mean Machine. He's the one that really showed me my future.
Wow, okay.
That little Spanish rap piece and that one song toward the end, I saw a bigger picture. So I give the credit to Mr. Schick. There are people who don't know who this man is. He was a great Puerto Rican rapper out of the Bronx. Mm. And he deserves his props and his credit. I'm just the one that took it global first.
Okay. Mellow Man Ace, what would you like the world to know about you? And what are you working on now? We've got about 2 minutes to wrap this up. But I want to know what your current projects are. I know you got a release out. And what does the future hold for Mellow Man Ace?
Okay. Man, you know, to be honest with you, I'm very approachable. Just want the fans to know I'm very approachable. I'm very humble. I've had my moments in life that have given me my humble pie, and I'm thankful for those lows as well as all the highs, and I think they've helped to make me a well-rounded man. So just know that I'm approachable. I've never shunned from an interview or a autograph or a photo op from anybody. So if you see me, go ahead and approach me. I'm a cool dude. You know, I stay humble. What I'm working on right now, realistically, at this particular time, is nothing. I'm not writing right now. I do have some projects out. As last year, I put out a record called So Rough, So Tough that did really well for me on the underground level, especially at Sirius Radio. You know, radio can be a very complicated realm. But we try not to play that game anymore. And, you know, in return for spins, you got to then pay it back out of your royalties and all these other things that occur there. But, you know, and I just recently, I will say I gave, it wasn't really a release. I wrote a song called Divine Thoughts, and I shot a video for it, and I never released it. I just put it out through my YouTube channel for those who are subscribers of my music to have this as a gift, because the song is really deep. And after, you know, Donald Trump took office, I got very depressed and I needed to get it off my chest. So I wrote this piece called Divine Thoughts, and it's my gift to the world. And that's out right now on only YouTube. It was never released. I never asked anybody to buy it. This is just like, you know, when you have so many hip-hop legends passing on right now, I felt like, okay, how are you going to be remembered? And if I drop dead today or tomorrow, whatever, because no man is promised no other day, right? I want people to go back and say, man, he was trying to leave us something. He died for hip-hop. And that's really it. I'm in that part of my life where I'm just trying to drop legacy bars. And if it has no importance and it's shallow-minded or ratchet or you know, I'm not doing it. I already did those records 25, 26 years ago. Now as a grown man, you know what I mean? It's important that I leave a legacy for my son, and he could see that if I died today, I died for hip-hop, and I left the world.
Okay.
That's it, man. That's it.
Now, are there outlets, however, where people can go and purchase your music?
Absolutely. You can always go on iTunes and all those Spotify guys and find, you know, those early works, and you can find those middle works as well, the ones that never hit popular radio. And there's a lot of great material, I feel, you know, like that I've left on these catalogs. You know, my last album, which I put out, I want to say it was a year and a half ago, called The Lost Decade, has a lot of gems in that one. And the album that is a real sleeper that I feel I did my absolute best work on, Restoring Order, is out there as well. Look for those. For those who are purists and love real music without the fluff and the hoopla of mainstream media, find those records, because I've left you a lot of gems.
Wow. Mellow Man Ace, we want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop. We want to thank you for your time coming to do this show. And we want to wish you the best, my brother. And whatever you do, we know it's going to be creative bomb. Mellow Man Ace, blessings to you, my brother. Thank you very much.
Much love and respect.
You've been listening to Mellow Man Ace, hip-hop pioneer, on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. Don't go away. We've got more guests coming up, and we're going to explore this worldwide culture that we call hip-hop, a culture that we all love. Thank you.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye.
Hey, what's going on? You know what I'm saying? This is Grand Focaccia right now. You know what I'm saying? Mr. Clean Cut put together. Oh, man, you got to wait till you hear this, man. It's called Bob's Live number 3 theme song. Man, he got down and done it right, man. I'm saying, because I'm listening to it, and I'm like, damn.
Oh, hey,
what the hell?
We over here breaking records of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Bob's Live, Robin Lynn, maybe. Got you playing again.
Time.
DJ, time to spin. Live, live, character surprise. And the world vibes. Stretch for that exercise.